There was a 4 to 6 million person demonstration across the country for our collective values and for our country. And we were all united, and we were all peaceful, and we were all hopeful. And so let's take that vibe into this fight, because this one we can win.
What?
There's a fight that we can win? Put me in, coach.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliates, both terrestrial and on the internets across the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition. As our brilliant friend and semi-regular roundtabler here on the Bradcast, a fella known by largely by the name Driftglass, as he posted last night on Blue Sky in response to my posting of yesterday's program, quote, "The Bradcast is always a three-course meal." Well, he's not wrong. The meal may not always taste very good. But let's begin today with this appetizer. And hello, Desi Doyen.
Hey.
You're not the appetizer, but actually you sort of are. There you go. I don't know what that even means.
Neither do
but
I.
But there's a remarkable split that seems to be underway within MAGA right now. And of course, because it's MAGA, it's not just a policy disagreement among them. It must turn into thermonuclear war. In this case, on whether Donald Trump, who was allowed to pretend for years to be anti-war, despite all evidence to the contrary, for those willing to pay attention to the facts, rather than the Trump spin, and so many Republicans, by the way, who have been desperate to pretend now that they were not strongly in favor of George W. Bush's long forever wars abroad, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the rest of his so-called global war on terror following 9/11 that they all supported for so many years until they decided that they wanted to pretend that they didn't. So a bit of a delectable appetizer here to kick off your three-course meal today. Here is Tucker Carlson, one of those pretend Johnny come lately to an anti-war position MAGA folks, versus Ted Cruz, a longtime Republican pro-warrior who has only pretended to be anti-war enough to help get Donald Trump elected two times. This is a teaser that was posted on Tuesday night by Carlson of his full interview, I guess, with Ted Cruz, that I suppose will be airing today wherever the hell it is that Tucker Carlson's actually airs, whatever his program is, after he was fired by Fox News. Warning, by the way, while it may make little sense in the world of reality, and it may not be particularly filling of an appetizer, it is nonetheless a delicious one, I think.
How many people live in Iran, by the way?
I don't know the population.
At all?
No, I don't know the population.
You don't know the population of the country you seek to topple?
How many people live in Iran?
92 million.
Okay. Yeah.
How could you not know that?
I don't sit around memorizing population tables.
Well, it's kind of relevant because you're calling for the overthrow of the government.
Why is it relevant whether it's 90 million or 80 million or 100 million? Why is that relevant?
Because if you don't know anything about the country...
I didn't say I don't know anything about
the country. Okay, what's the ethnic mix of Iran?
They are Persians and predominantly Shia. Okay, this is cute.
No, it's not even... You don't know anything about Iran. So
okay,
actually,
I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran.
You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government.
You're the one who
claims anything about the country.
No, you don't know anything about the country. You're the one who claims they're not trying to murder Donald Trump. You're the one who can't figure out if it was a good idea to kill General Soleimani, and you said it was bad.
You don't believe they're trying to murder Trump.
Yes, I do.
Because you're not calling for military strikes against them in retaliation. And if you really believe that.
We're carrying out military strikes today.
You said Israel was.
Right, with our help. Israel is leading them, but we're supporting them.
Well, this you're breaking news here because the U.S. government last night denied, the National Security Council spokesman Alex Pfeiffer denied on behalf of Trump that we were acting on Israel's behalf in any offensive capacity.
No, we're not bombing them. Israel's bombing them.
You just said we were.
We are supporting Israel.
This is high stakes. You're a senator. If you're saying the United States government is at war with Iran right now, people are listening.
Okay.
Okay, so, well, that almost gets me to want to tune in to Tucker Carlson's show.
No, it doesn't.
And I have no idea where even to watch it. But anyway, as AOC might say, sounds like the girls are fighting again. But it is hilarious, if at least the stakes weren't so deadly high. As researcher Michael Gallant of the Center for Economic and Policy Research wrote at Responsible Statecraft way back on January 21, 2021. So this would be the first day of the Joe Biden presidency after the first term of Donald Trump. He wrote, Donald Trump ended his term in office just as he started it, lying about being anti-war. During the 2016 election campaign, Trump rose to the top of a crowded Republican primary field by styling himself as an insurgent outsider. A key component of this rebrand was the repeated insistence that he stood alone in the field as being anti-war. Claiming, without evidence, I would say actually counter to the available evidence, that he had opposed the invasion of Iraq. Trump lambasted the bipartisan foreign policy establishment for its decades of disastrous militarism. For a war-weary nation at the time, back during the 2016 campaign, desperate for change, this was evidence enough that Trump would be different. The anti-war label somehow stuck, and it would be repeated over and over, up to the very final days of his presidency. But with 4 years of accumulated evidence, Gallant writes, all pointing in the same direction, it is time to kill this myth once and for all. Sure, Donald Trump didn't launch a new all-out ground invasion on the scale of Iraq, but he did escalate conflict in every theater of war that he inherited, repeatedly brought the country to the brink of new wars, and recklessly threw around U.S. power with no regard for the many lives that it would cost. The so-called anti-war candidate was a pro-war president, writes Gallant at Responsible Statecraft back again in early 2021, just after Trump left office. Now, Gallant, he goes on to offer the receipts for the claim that he is making here. He details how Trump escalated inherited wars. He added fuel to their fire by increasing troop levels. He deepened reliance on private contractors in these conflicts. He dramatically scaled up aerial warfare, drones and such. He did not necessarily repeal the 2001 and 2002 authorizations for the use of military force, but he expanded conflicts under both of them, along with 4 consecutive years of growth for the already bloated Pentagon budget, and he expanded the U.S.'s deadly use of drone wars around the world. He went all in on Yemen in support of the Saudis and the UAE, repeatedly using his veto power to block bipartisan majorities in Congress that had tried to stop that. He unilaterally shredded longtime anti-nuclear treaties with Russia. He sold weapons to dictators around the world, stoking wars, including cold wars, with nations like China. He instituted a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, eschewing diplomacy in favor of military threats. And he ordered the illegal assassination of Iran's beloved top military general, bringing our nations to the brink of catastrophe at the time. I hope everyone remembers this because, boy, this sure seems like when we got to the 2024 elections, they forgot and they were repeating the same Trump is an anti-war president nonsense. And, of course, You'll recall, I hope, that Trump unilaterally reneged and ripped up the long-fought and hard-won anti-nuclear deal between the U.S. and Iran and six other nations that resulted in Iran's nuclear enrichment program being cut to nothing for years after it was, or initially after the deal was struck in 2015 by the Obama administration, only to become quickly ramped up to higher and higher levels than ever in the ensuing years since Trump pulled the U.S. out of it, blocking much of our eyes and ears on their uranium enrichment program ever since. Even though to this day, as Trump's own Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, recently claimed, testified to about in Congress, the U.S. intelligence community believes that Iran is still many years away from having a usable nuclear weapon and that its supreme leader had not, in fact, ordered the nation's military and scientists to create one.
The IC continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, and Supreme Leader Khamenei has not authorized the nuclear weapons program that he suspended in 2003.
So that was Donald Trump's own Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, just back in March. Nonetheless, Israel, in particular Israel's warlord Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has been itching to attack Iran to supposedly target its nuclear program for going on some 20 years now, repeatedly telling us year after year after year that Iran was just months, if not days, away from having nuclear weapons. Now, I hate to sound like Tucker Carlson here, who is, once again, a useful idiot. At least this time he's a useful idiot for, you know, the truth when it comes to the idea of attacking Iran. But in this vacuum of leadership, with the return of Trump to the White House and Netanyahu believing himself to be untouchable, he finally launched his attack on Iran. With Donald Trump, at first, claiming the U.S. had nothing to do with it, even if he then admitted, well, of course, we knew about it. We knew about it before it happened. That's, of course, why he told a bunch of Americans to leave in the Middle East. And he later described the effort to attack Iran not as Israel doing so, but, quote, us, we attacked Iran. Just as Ted Cruz sort of did there in his conversation with Tucker Carlson. Even as Trump had been begging Iran over the past month or so to agree to a new nuclear deal that was offered to him by Donald Trump, which looked almost exactly like the old nuclear deal that was struck under Barack Obama that Trump tore up, calling it the worst deal ever at the time, despite its unchallenged success at ending Iranian uranium enrichment with full inspections by the international authorities. But he had to rip that up because, well, the old deal had Obama's name on it, not Trump, so now he needs a new deal, even if it looks exactly the same. As Matthew Duss wrote at Foreign Policy back in 2023, quote, calling Trump an anti-imperialist is also nonsense. The anti-war left should not fall for this dishonest pitch. And of course, I can't speak for the anti-war left, but I can tell you that I have never fallen for that pitch, even though I know that a lot of folks on the left did. Oh, Donald Trump, he's anti-war. Is he? No, he's not. And now, with Israel having seemingly gained the upper hand against Iran with their attack, Trump wants to be a part of what he believes is the winning team here, or at least, you know, slap his name on what he sees as a potential easy win, the way he comes into an already completed business and slaps his name on that so that he can take credit for it. Which is exactly how these forever wars always seem to start, by the way. So he now claims to be weighing whether or not the U.S. will further join Israel's increasingly one-sided attack on Iran by supplying the bunker buster bombs that only the U.S. apparently has access to that would be needed in order to truly end whatever Iran's nuclear program actually is, whatever it is or whatever it isn't, currently buried deep, deep below a mountain in Iran. They need the U.S. for that. And yet, doing that would risk entering the U.S. into, yes, another so-called forever war in the Middle East, this time with Iran and its proxies across the Middle East, which is exactly what many MAGA folks like Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon have convinced themselves and their MAGA dupes to believe that Donald Trump was actually against. That he would never, ever do anything like that, only to recently, apparently, find out otherwise now that Trump is considering doing so, doing exactly that. Now that longtime hawks and Trump buddies like Sean Hannity and Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz, etc., are doing what they always do when any Republican is in the White House, they begin banging the drum for more war in the Middle East. And a whole bunch of MAGA folks are in favor of it, and a whole bunch of MAGA folks are against it. And I'm enjoying the civil war between them, which brings us back to today and at least, the hopeful end to the Donald Trump is anti-war myth as the civil war breaks out within MAGA. And a new test, as Greg Sargent details today at New Republic, is now underway in Congress for those supposed so-called anti-war MAGA Republicans. You may have heard it said that Donald Trump won in 2024 in part by vowing to end forever wars, writes Greg. During the campaign, Trump ripped Democrat Kamala Harris for campaigning with Liz Cheney, slamming her for wanting, quote, war with every Muslim country known to mankind. News organizations credulously insisted that this sort of anger over military entanglements in Iraq and Afghanistan fueled Trump's movement. Some even suggested that war fatigue, not his unflagging affection for Vladimir Putin, must have driven Trump MAGA opposition to arming Ukraine. Writes Sargent, a new battle between Trump and Tucker Carlson over Israel's war with Iran is severely undermining that understanding of MAGA. Carlson and MAGA podcaster Steve Bannon, among others, have been urging Trump not to deploy the U.S. military in tandem with Israel. Trump appears close, however, to doing so, and people like Carlson and Bannon are loudly proclaiming that this would betray the MAGA movement, which in turn is angering Trump. Oh, I bet it is, or at least I hope it is. What's triggering Trump is Carlson claiming Trump is, quote, complicit in this war, apparently due to Trump's expression of support for Israeli strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities and top military leadership, as Trump is now weighing whether to deploy American B-2 bombers to help destroy Iran's nuclear enrichment facility at Fordo, which would entangle the U.S. in exactly the sort of Mideast conflict that he vowed to avoid, observes Sargent.
And would also put U.S. service members in harm's way.
Yep.
You have to fly those bombers.
Of course. All of this, writes Greg, has deeply split the MAGA coalition, with Carlson denouncing top Fox News figures like Sean Hannity for actively encouraging Trump to pursue, quote, direct U.S. military involvement abroad, slamming them as warmongers. You know, just like the warmonger Carlson spent years being himself until I guess he saw the writing on the wall that nobody actually liked those forever wars, and he decided to pretend that, oh, he was against them because Republicans are the anti-war party after all, or whatever it is that Trump ran and won twice, hoaxing his followers into believing, but which Carlson apparently took very seriously and is now mad that Fox News and Donald Trump didn't. How does this supposed anti-war sentiment really run inside of MAGA? Asks Sargent. Well, here's a test, he notes. Republican Representative Thomas Massie on Tuesday this week introduced a House resolution barring Trump from entering into war with Iran without Congress's explicit authorization. Co-sponsored by Democratic Representative Ro Khanna, this so-called privileged measure will get a vote in the U.S. House unless House Speaker Mike Johnson procedurally thwarts it somehow. There's some evidence, some debate, I should say, over whether the legislative vehicle this measure uses is actually binding on a president, and Trump would veto anything that would be, in fact, binding on him. But a vote would force members on record and a statement of broad opposition to war without authorization that would send a very strong message that MAGA really does want him to resist foreign entanglements. Do you think this bill will ever come up for a vote? We will see. As Khanna told Sargent, quote, it's a test of whether the MAGA movement is really anti-war. What's more, he says, many Democrats oppose war with Iran as foreign policies. Matt Duss argues this week Trump helped pave the way to this moment by withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. Our intelligence services have not assessed that Iran has decided to produce nuclear weapons and that rushing into war now would be illegal and further destabilize the Middle East. Leading Democrats have endorsed a similar view. Massey's resolution has a number of Democratic co-sponsors. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia has introduced a similar resolution in the upper chamber of Congress. So we'll see. As Khanna told Sargent, this is a test for both parties and whether we're going to have an anti-war party in America at all. The push for a resolution constraining Trump also highlights another impulse of MAGA that counters the anti-war canard. He says, Sargent says, it's hard to see how MAGA will support limits on Donald Trump's war-making powers or anything else that risks diluting his aura of so-called strength. But guess what? He asks, MAGA Republicans can prove all of this wrong by supporting the resolution reasserting congressional control over war-making authority, you know, like it reads in the Constitution, geared toward accomplishing what MAGA itself claims to be for, fewer forever wars abroad. But as Sargent concludes today, it's unlikely many congressional Republicans who've ceded so much authority to Trump already will do anything of the sort. Trump demonstrated exactly what MAGA is really made of when he tweeted this, quote, America first means many great things, including the fact that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. Make America great again, all caps. In other words, writes Greg, Trump grasps that America First, or MAGA, is simply whatever he says it is at any given time, and here it may mean enthusiastically backing war with Iran. Will MAGA robotically go along? Sargent notes, we will soon find out. And we will see how long Carlson and Bannon are able to hold out to the Trump is anti-war, MAGA is anti-war myths. But make no mistake, no matter what happens here, they are myths. Speaking of age-old Republican myths and hypocrisy, remember when Republicans, now way back in 2010, so I guess you got to be older than 15 years old to remember this. But way back in 2010, during the brutal fight over the creation of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, by MAGA Republicans at the time, who then called themselves the Tea Party. Remember how they were they were at least instructed to be furious about the idea of Obama's new health plan that ended up giving access to health care to tens of millions of Americans. Now, by the way, as many, if not more, Republicans than Democrats. But back then, oh, they were furious. They were furious about it all as they told us that big government should not come between a patient and their doctor and that was an outrage. Remember that from 2010? And then remember when Trump first ran for office back in 2016 as a champion at the time of LGBTQ rights. Remember that? He held up a rainbow flag at a campaign event with the words LGBTs for Trump written on it. Remember that? And some people actually believed him, believed that he supported LGBTQ rights, with Trump supporters like Chris Barron at the time, just days before the 2016 election, posting that photo while crowing, quote, "Trump made history last night. MSM wants to pretend it didn't happen. He's the most pro-LGBTQ presidential candidate ever nominated by either party." Remember that one? How about during the 2021 election cycle in Virginia, when Republican gubernatorial candidate Glenn Youngkin took back the governor's mansion from Democrats by running on the idea of parental rights? Remember that one? That the government should not interfere with parents, and that parents, not the government, should be able to decide what is right for their own children when it comes to everything from education to healthcare. It wasn't up to big government, it was up to parents. And it's about time that parents had a say in these things. And they decided back in 2021, when Glenn Youngkin won, that parental rights was going to be their ticket for Republicans moving forward after they had gotten clobbered the previous year in losing the White House to Joe Biden. Remember all of those things? All of them? Well, since we started today's show by quoting Driftglass today, let's go ahead and do it again here. As he likes to say, the seemingly bottomless sea of Republican hypocrisy out there, quote, "No fair remembering things." Well, guess what? We remember. It may not be fair, but we have very long memories around here, perhaps because we are not raging hypocritical liars. I don't know. But we're capable, actually, of remembering such things, even if Republicans would prefer that we do not, which means we notice. We notice. We see you, Republicans. We notice how appalling and hypocritical our corrupted activist far-right Republican U.S. Supreme Court majority, three justices actually handpicked by Donald Trump himself, how hypocritical and appalling they actually are, as they reminded us once again today. The Supreme Court on Wednesday upheld Tennessee's cruel ban on gender-affirming care for transgender minors. A jolting setback, as AP characterized it, to transgender rights. Using the case from Tennessee, the justices' 6-3 decision, with all Republican appointees upholding the ban and all Democratic appointees finding the ban in violation of the Constitution's protections against discrimination on the basis of sex, the decision effectively protects from legal challenges many efforts by President Donald Trump's Republican administration and state governments around the country to roll back protections for transgender people. Another 26 GOP-controlled states have laws that are similar to Tennessee's unspeakably cruel one. So, big government coming between a doctor and their patient? Check. LGBTQ rights rolled back by the Republican majority installed by the so-called on the Supreme Court by the so-called most pro-LGBTQ presidential candidate ever nominated by either party? Check. Parental rights overruled by state and federal law? Check, check, check. All of those things that Republicans had pretended for years to believe in, which we told you, of course, at the time were all lies. Well, what do you know? Proof, once again, today from the corrupt activist Republican majority on the U.S. Supreme Court that all of those things were lies. Lies, lies. And if you think they weren't, well, find me any Republican official out there today who is complaining about the trampling of rights, about the trampling of parental rights by these pro-Republican big government, anti-doctor patient, anti-LGBTQ, anti-parental rights laws, and SCOTUS's order finding them to be perfectly constitutional, thank you. Find me that Republican, will you? I'll wait patiently. Let me know. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for an, like I said, unspeakably cruel Republican majority here that the law banning puberty blockers and hormone treatments for trans minors does not violate the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, which requires the government to treat similarly situated people the same. Quote, this case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field. The voice in these debates raise sincere concerns. The implications for all are profound, Roberts writes. As if the debate about this was in any way sincere on the Republican side. He goes on to say the Equal Protection Clause does not resolve these disagreements, nor does it afford us license to decide them as best we see fit. But there is a fierce scientific policy debate about restricting doctors' treatment of trans kids, I guess. And because there is fierce debate, it's just fine in that case for the government to ban it altogether, just cause. All right, well, listen, I would like to fiercely debate that a Botox treatment gone terribly wrong for Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is why she was suddenly rushed to the hospital in an ambulance last night for still unknown reasons. But I'm going to go ahead and argue that it's a bad Botox treatment and that it's outrageous that people should use that at all. I say that we ban all Botox treatments for everybody. And because there's fierce debate about it, well, why not? Let's just do it. It would be totally legal. Totally constitutional. As AP writes in a dissent for the court's three liberal justices that she summarized aloud in the courtroom, something that justices do when they really, really want to bring attention to their outrage, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, by retreating from meaningful judicial review exactly where it matters most, the court abandons transgender children and their families to political whims. In sadness, I dissent, she said. The law also, Sotomayor noted, limits parents' decision-making ability for their children's health care. You know, parental rights. Got to limit that. You cool with that, Republicans? Yes, they are. The decision comes amid other federal and state efforts to regulate the lives of transgender people, including which sports they can play, which bathrooms they can use. In April, the Trump administration sued the state of Maine for not complying with the government's push to ban transgender athletes. The Republican president, the most pro-LGBTQ president ever, and apparently a scientific expert, has also sought to block federal spending on gender-affirming medical care for those under age of 19. He has kicked transgender service members out of the military, even as court fights continue, and he has signed an executive order purporting to define the sexes as only male and female, according to Dr. Trump. You know, his uncle went to MIT or something like that. So,
which he tells us frequently.
The president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, however, an actual medical doctor, Dr. Susan Cressley, said the organization is, quote, unwavering in its support of gender-affirming care and, quote, stands with pediatricians and families making healthcare decisions together and free from political interference. You know, the stuff that Republicans used to pretend to believe in. Chase Strangio, the ACLU lawyer who argued the case for transgender minors and their families, called the ruling on Wednesday a devastating loss for transgender people, our families, and everyone who cares about the Constitution. Tennessee's leading Republican elected officials, meanwhile, all praised the outcome because they are so much in favor of keeping big government from coming between doctors and the patients, and because they're so pro-parental rights. There are about 300,000 people in America between the ages of 13 and 17 and 1.3 million adults who identify as transgender in the U.S., according to the Williams Institute, a think tank at UCLA Law School that researches sexual orientation and gender identity. When the case was argued in December, then-President Joe Biden's Democratic administration and families of transgender adolescents called on the high court to strike down the Tennessee ban as unlawful sex discrimination and to protect the constitutional rights of vulnerable Americans. They argued the law violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, in part because the same treatments that the law prohibits for transgender minors can be used for other purposes. So they didn't ban a dangerous drug or something. They just banned the use of those drugs for certain purposes that they don't like. Even as doctors and parents find them medically necessary for children. A major issue in the case was the appropriate level of scrutiny that courts should apply to such laws. The lowest level is known as the rational basis review, and almost every law that is looked at that way is actually upheld. Indeed, the Federal Appeals Court in Cincinnati that allowed the Tennessee law to be enforced in the first place held that lawmakers acted rationally to regulate medical procedures. The appeals court reversed a trial court that employed a higher level of review called heightened scrutiny, which applies in cases of sex discrimination. Under this more searching examination, the state must identify an important governmental objective and show that the law helps to accomplish it. But they know they can't do that, so they really don't want to argue this case under heightened scrutiny. They want to argue it under rational basis review. And the Supreme Court agreed that would be just fine, thanks. Roberts's 24-page majority opinion was devoted mostly to explaining why the Tennessee law called SB1 should be evaluated under that lower standard of review. The law's restrictions on treating minors for gender dysphoria turn on age and medical use, not sex, Roberts wrote, because if it was sex, well, higher scrutiny. Doctors, he said, may prescribe puberty blockers and hormone therapy to minors of any sex to treat some disorders, but not those relating to transgender status, he wrote. So using this thinking, they're arguing this law has nothing to do with classifying people on the basis of sex, which would require that heightened scrutiny, or even whether or not they even identify as transgender as a class. This law affects everyone. It affects you and me, Des. Sort of the way the old saying goes about the laws that prevent poor people from sleeping on the streets under bridges at night. Such laws, the saying goes, are not discriminatory against poor people because they do not discriminate between the rich and the poor. Neither of them are allowed to sleep under a bridge at night. So see, this isn't a law against poor people, much as this isn't a law against transgender kids. In her courtroom statement, Sotomayor asserted that similar arguments to the majority's were made to defend the Virginia law that once prohibited interracial marriage that the Supreme Court struck down in 1967. Quote, a ban on interracial marriage could be described in the same way as the majority described Tennessee's SB1, she said. Roberts rejected that comparison. I bet he did. All right, a couple more courses still to come on today's three-course broadcast, including Desi Doyen in our latest Green News Report. What else is ahead? I don't know. You'll find out as soon as I do on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't clear those dishes.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Well, Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I hope to dive into some of the legislative details on this, hopefully on tomorrow's program. But for the moment, since Republicans are taking a victory lap today at the Supreme Court, where they've convinced themselves they're, you know, protecting the health care of children by preventing those children from being able to take part in medical treatments prescribed by their own doctors and approved by their own parents. Just a quick reminder today that the Republicans in Congress are still moving forward with Donald Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill that encompasses his entire second-term legislative agenda by cutting health care and nutritional food assistance by more than $1 trillion to low-income, elderly, and disabled men, women, and children. Analysts find that it will take away health care entirely from at least 14 million Americans. It will increase the national debt, something else that Republicans usually pretend to be concerned about, by at least $3 trillion, all in order to pay for tax cuts of about $4 trillion, mostly for the wealthy and big corporations. It will also kill pretty much all of the Biden administration tax breaks for clean energy upgrades for American households.
Yep.
And for clean energy tax breaks for the clean renewable energy industry that have otherwise led to a manufacturing boom here in the U.S. Well, now the House has already narrowly passed their version of this GOP bill in a partisan vote. By one single vote, it passed out of the House. The Senate is now finishing up their version of the same bill, which is reportedly even worse than the House version, incredibly enough, especially since it already included both the largest cuts to health care and largest tax cuts ever in one single big, terrible bill. But while I fear that some of the Senate Republicans who used to claim that they oppose the bill because of how much it would add to the deficit, you know, people like Senator Ron Johnson, who claimed he was an absolute no, but now he's sort of warming up to it, seems just fine with it. I fear that that's what's happening with this bill, and that it is all largely going unnoticed due to so many other things. Israel, Iran, military style migrant roundups, selected officials being roughed up and arrested by Trump's ICE goons, etc. I fear that many Americans may not fully appreciate what it is that Trump and the Republicans are now doing right now, even while we're distracted with everything else. But maybe my fears are overblown. I don't know, at least based on the miserable polling that we are seeing for this measure pretty much across the board right now among the American people.
Yeah, maybe some of that is starting to break through so that people can finally understand it.
A Washington Post survey released on Tuesday this week found Americans opposed the GOP budget bill by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. Just 23% of Americans support the bill. 23%, according to this poll. 42% are opposed. That means, of course, that there are still some 34% who claim to have no opinion. But of those who do have an opinion, they really do not like this bill by an almost 2-to-1 margin. Even among Republicans, the bill is unpopular, with the post-Ipsos survey finding just 49% currently support it. Even worse for Republicans, the bill's approval fares even worse among people who have, quote, heard a great deal or a good amount about the bill, with 64% opposed compared to 33% in support. So in other words, the more people, even Republicans, hear about the bill, the more they oppose the bill. That, I suppose, is also good news, even if it may now depend on our corporate media to help educate about the bill for the rest of the people that have not heard about it. Good luck to us all. It's not just the Washington Post. A Kaiser Family Foundation health poll, KFF health poll, found similar results. 64% of Americans viewed the legislation unfavorably in their polling. Even worse for Trump and the GOP is that those two polls were conducted before Senate Republicans released their changes to the House-passed version of the bill, which is said to be even worse. I hope to discuss that in more detail soon. It would make more draconian cuts to Medicaid and SNAP, food assistance, and the Affordable Care Act, and even Medicare, apparently. CNN's polling guy, Harry Enten, put all of this into perspective on Tuesday.
You know, I'm really, really surprised when I look at polling data. I look at it every day. But the amount of disapproval for this bill, holy cow, my goodness gracious. And, you know, you mentioned the KFF poll. We're talking about 29 points underwater on the net favorable rating. But that matches the Quinnipiac University poll from last week when it was 26 points underwater. Oh, my God, you need Greg Louganis to get that far underwater. And, I mean, we're talking about a negative 41 net favorability rating among independents in the center of the electorate. You rarely ever see pieces of legislation or proposed pieces of legislation as unpopular as this. But here you see it in two polls, 26 points underwater and 29 points underwater. No good.
Give us some comparison. 2017, we saw a bill that had Trump tax cuts in it. What does the support look like compared to that?
Yeah, you know, that wasn't that popular back in the day. It was a minus 17 net favorable rating. But here, what do we see with the big, beautiful bill on the aggregate? Minus 28 points. So this is far more unpopular than that. Those tax cuts were back in 2017. And remember, Republicans lost the House in 2018. So if this is the big, beautiful bill, it may be a big, beautiful bill for Democrats if it passes, because they'll have a big, beautiful night come midterm night of 2026.
In my sad math, that is almost double.
Yes.
There. Almost.
It's not good. It's not good.
No good. My goodness gracious. Harry Enten on CNN. Not good for Republicans in any event, and Donald Trump. But maybe that is good for Americans. We will see if that's good for Democrats. If, like Trump and the Republicans' attempt to kill Obamacare during his first term, if enough senators can cross the aisle to block this abomination. Either way, I think while it might hurt a lot of Americans politically, it is kind of insane what Republicans are doing here. Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii speaking with the Midas Touch podcast on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. I think this was on Tuesday, argued that, as horrible as this may be for the American people, this is a real opportunity for Democrats to come together to potentially defeat this bill.
There is no bill that's been more unpopular, not the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, not the last round of tax cuts, both of which were super unpopular. But this stuff is like underwater in a very, very politically deadly way. And I think the reason is because it is, people are starting to register two things. One, all of the terrible policy and what's going to happen to communities everywhere, in particular, the Medicaid cuts and the nutritional assistance cuts and the, you know, attempt to basically constrain energy supply and raise the cost of electricity for most Americans, so that you got that basket of things that they do to quote unquote save money. But I think people didn't quite understand that the reason that they're trying to quote unquote save money is to generate enough revenue to provide extraordinary tax cuts for people making more than $4 million a year. So usually, you know, those policies are super unpopular in the first place, but when you combine them, they get sort of exponentially more unpopular because they just have no constituency except people making more than $4 million a year. So I actually think the main thing for us to remember is that we can still kill this bill. It is true that they have control over the Congress. It is also true that some of them are getting quite scared of the prospect of electricity prices going up, of people who receive $6 a day for nutritional assistance, getting that cut, and all for people who are not their constituents getting the biggest tax cut in the history of the United States. So there are a lot of scary things happening right now. This is something I'm quite optimistic about. I think we can kill this bill.
How do we do it? How do we kill it?
Look, it is a peaceful, pluralistic, nonviolent, but still aggressive movement to stand up for our collective values. And I gotta say, you know, there has been a lot of good consternation and then a lot of unproductive consternation about the sort of state of the left. And we spent a good amount of time doing our introspection, but now it's time to fight. We spent a fair amount of time talking about whether the center left or the hard left or the middle of the left, you know, should lead the party. I don't care about that fight anymore because we are all united in killing this bill. And we have to stay united in killing this bill. And one of the things that made me the most excited and hopeful for the future is that this last Saturday, there was a 4 to 6 million person demonstration across the country for our collective values and for our country. And we were all united and we were all peaceful and we were all hopeful. And so let's take that vibe into this fight, because this one we can win.
So that was Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. To be frank, I'd be surprised if Democrats can kill this bill outright. They might, however, be able to do what that pull off that miracle like they did on the Affordable Care Act back in 2017 and stop this thing if enough Republicans come over to help kill this so-called big, beautiful bill. But you know what? Senator Schatz obviously knows more about politics, specifically U.S. Senate politics in this case, than I do. So I very much hope he is right and I am wrong about this. The upside being that if this bill does pass, unpopular as it is, it sounds like it will be an absolute bloodbath by voters in response to it at the ballot box in next year's midterms. As I say, hopefully more details on the Senate version of this nightmare soon. And Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. All right, we ran out of time on yesterday's broadcast for the Green News Report. So a day late and always, by the way, a dollar short. let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
It's just Mother Nature at its worst.
Deadly flooding strikes West Virginia and Texas as Trump cancels flood control upgrades. Trump administration scraps agreement to restore salmon in the Columbia River. Plus,
what was lost in a generation can return in a generation.
United Nations Oceans Summit calls for an end to ocean plunder.
All of those calls and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's just Mother Nature at its worst. And so it's not something that's easy to foresee.
Actually, a lot of people foresaw it, Governor Morrissey of West Virginia. You just didn't care. Hey, why don't you stop mining for coal? That'd help. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, after our grim 1500th report a few days ago, I can only imagine what you've got for us today.
Well, first up, deadly floods strike again in the United States.
I knew it.
In northern West Virginia, flash flooding caused by torrential rains over the weekend killed at least 6 people. 4 inches of rain fell in just half an hour on Saturday, inundating roads, damaging vital infrastructure, destroying dozens of homes, and partially collapsing an apartment building. Mm. This is the same storm system that killed at least 13 people last week in San Antonio, Texas, with similar sudden torrential rains generating raging flash floods. Studies show that man-made climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels is making intense rainfall events more frequent and extreme.
So in West Virginia, where they've been mining for coal for generations, and they really don't seem to want to give it up, well, now they're kind of paying the price for that, eh?
Yes, they are.
Sadly.
Huffington Post reports that while Donald Trump politicized disaster relief during the 2024 presidential campaign, since his inauguration, Trump has made 0 visits to dozens of communities that have suffered extreme weather disasters. And the administration has pulled the rug out from under vulnerable communities trying to upgrade their aging flood control systems to protect against future floods. Trump canceled FEMA's $5 billion Building Resilience Resilient Communities Program, which CBS News reports is disproportionately hurting flood-prone Republican-leaning communities. In Louisiana, $185 million in grants abruptly canceled. The administration called the program wasteful and political. Here's Mayor Wade Evans of Central Louisiana, whose town needs that funding.
Any person that flooded is shocked that it would be considered politics to do flood mitigation. It should be considered common sense.
Yeah, well, you know what's wasteful and political? Spending $45 million of taxpayer money on your own military birthday parade instead of actually helping the citizens of your country.
In Nigeria, widespread floods triggered by days of torrential rains have killed more than 200 people, with hundreds still missing. The worst flooding in the region in 60 years. In other news, the United Nations World Oceans Summit concluded late last week in France, with countries moving closer to ratifying the Treaty of the High Seas, the first legally binding agreement to protect the world's oceans and marine biodiversity in international waters. But there were no new financial pledges to assist developing countries with rising sea levels, and no agreement on halting wildly destructive deep-sea mining, plastic pollution, or overfishing. The Trump administration did not participate.
They did not even show up.
In conjunction with the conference, a new study warns that ocean acidification, the evil twin of the climate crisis, has reached critical levels. Ocean acidification occurs when humanity's CO2 emissions react chemically with seawater, making it more acidic and corrosive. That affects the ocean food supply, in part by making it harder for marine animals and corals to build their shells, affecting and threatening entire underwater ecosystems. But the author underscored that decreasing CO2 emissions from burning fossil fuels is the only way to solve acidification globally.
We watched Ocean with David Attenborough over the weekend on Disney Plus. I highly recommend it for exactly these issues.
Finally, here in the U.S., the Trump administration canceled a billion-dollar Biden-era settlement agreement with three Pacific Northwest tribal nations, halting a government-wide initiative to restore previously abundant salmon runs in the Columbia River Basin. The settlement would have enabled the removal of hydroelectric dams that harm salmon populations and billions of dollars in funding for new clean energy sources. The Trump administration claimed ditching the settlement was protecting the country from, quote, radical green agenda policies.
When do we get to ditch the Trump administration? For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Let the river run. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, or you want to hear it again, share it with friends, family, colleagues, and enemies, you can do so for free at bradblog.com. But hey, while you're there, help us to not be a dollar short for a change by hitting one of those donate buttons or going straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, I am the Brad Blog. I will see you there until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.